Must be the cue to start.
That is the cue to start. Hello.
Welcome. Welcome to Advanced Automation Using Windows PowerShell. Let's just jump right in and do the little intros. Why don't we start with the distinguished person?
All right. Howdy. Jeffrey Snover. Is my mic on? Yeah. Okay. My mic's on. I'm Jeffrey Snover, a distinguished engineer, and now I'm lead architect for Windows Server and System Center Data Center products.
My name is Don Jones. I'm a Windows PowerShell MVP. Books about Windows PowerShell. I write the Windows PowerShell column for TechNet magazine, do a lot of PowerShell training, and I'm also one of the founders of PowerShell.org. I know a lot of you picked it up, but we've got some books up here at the end of the stage, so after the session, if you didn't grab one, feel free. There's some stickers, help yourself. If we do run out, head down to the scripting guys booth in the community resource zone, and there's lots more. So here was our kind of plan for today. We didn't really make one. But we thought what would be fun is to go over some of the advanced things in Windows PowerShell, some of the advanced techniques that are available to help with specific different scenarios when it comes to automation. Now, the idea here was not to just blow your minds with as many advanced PowerShell things as we could throw at you. We're going to really try and relate these to why you would use them in a production environment. And so we'll just kind of go back and forth, but if you guys have got questions, there's floor mics. So feel free to ask questions. We may go off on a tangent, we may go in a different direction, we may wind up talking about completely different stuff, who knows, we'll just try and keep it fun and casual. So what are we gonna do first?
All right.
Apparently demos.
I think apparently demos. Right. You said, oh, the key thing is that what we're gonna show you is all based upon PowerShell version 3. So we're not showing the PowerShell version 4 stuff, we're focused in on the 3 stuff and...
And probably the majority of what we're gonna show you we'll work with PowerShell 2 as well, to some degree.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is all go home and use it right now level stuff.
Exactly. That was the focus for this talk.
Okay. All right. First up, make a commandlet. So I'll do this one here.
All right.
One of the words that I've kind of been flogging around the industry a little bit is tool making. I come from the machining industry, where the guys who actually push the button to make parts don't get paid very much. The person who gets paid is the person who makes the tools that make the parts. Think about how that applies to your environment. Would you rather be the button monkey clicking next, 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 or would you rather be the person who makes the scripts that no one can live without? That's job security. And so this whole idea of tool making is every single time you sit down to write a script, think about how you can write it in a way so that you will never have to run it, or that you will not have to maintain it much. Make it a tool that you can hand to a cheaper person so that you can get on to writing the tool. There's two benefits of this. Number one, you will have better job security. Number two, you will have to speak to your end users a lot less. Those are both huge benefits. So the idea of packaging functionality into a tool in PowerShell is really simple with something like this, which is called an advanced function. Informally, some folks will refer to this as a script commandlet, because you get all of the capability of a native C-sharp authored command, really, and it looks and feels and smells and tastes just like a command, but it's really just script. How many of you are big programmers, love programming, can't get enough of it? How many of you could totally live without it? Yep, many more people. This isn't really a lot of programming. If you look
we didn't ask them how their PowerShell usage was. How many are beginner PowerShell users here? Learning to become beginners.
Oh, good.
Okay, great. And how many are already advanced? Okay, good.
About half and half. So if you look at this.
Guaranteed to disappoint at least one half.
At least one half.
The mystery will be which half.
This highlighted bit is really the functional part here. This is what makes this thing work. The rest of it is just a bunch of declarative stuff that tells PowerShell what to do with it. So if I just, I've got a line here at the bottom that runs this, and I'm just going to take off the parameter. I'm going to give this thing no input whatsoever, and just run it real quick. You can see that PowerShell is smart enough to prompt me. It knows that it needs a computer name because I just told it, hey, this information's mandatory. And notice this little square bracket 0? That's actually telling me that I can type in multiples, and when I get done, I can hit enter, and it'll go ahead and run those. I've designed this in a way that it spits out output just like a real command. When something goes wrong, I can display a warning. If I wanted to see a little bit more detail about what's happening, maybe add a minus verbose to the end of it. So it'll prompt me for the same information, but now it's going to show me a little bit more detail about what's happening.
Ooh.
So I didn't know it did this in blue in this theme. That's pretty.
Can you read it? Turns out blue
no,
on
very
black
low contrast,
is the least possible,
but it feels very disco.
Least readable thing in the world.
I can ask for help on this thing. Put a little minus question mark on there, hit run. And it displays help just like what a real command help would look like. So there's lots of resources out there if you want to dig into all this, including the documentation. You can run help star advanced star, and it will help you find the docs for this stuff. But the idea is to go down the path of making everything you possibly can into this kind of unit, because you can then bundle this up, pass it around your organization, put it on a file share someplace so everybody can get to it, and you don't have to run the tools anymore. You're just the person who makes the tools and maintains the tools. This is the key bit right there, and it's an easy bit to miss as you're walking through these, but that commandlet binding declaration turns on all of these advanced features, like telling this that the computer name parameter is mandatory and that it can accept its input from the pipeline, just like a real command, that it accepts multiple values. It can handle errors because I've used this error action parameter. So, I mean, this is kind of what you guys envisioned when you created this whole concept, right? Was
Indeed.
Building tools that look like a command.
Absolutely. You know, actually, we got some beginners in the room, so maybe we should start one step before this.
Okay.
Let me just show you something. Okay, so this is my machine with a real mouse.
This year we brought our own laptops. I don't know if you caught our talk last year, but
it was
never present on someone else's laptop.
Yeah. So imagine I've got something here that says get process star SS. Okay, and I save that. I can just save that as a file and run it, right? Bonk, run it, gets that. Okay, now if you want to, then what you do is you put it in a function. And of course, this is an ad hoc function, so all my ad hoc functions, I can't type, function is named T.
Really, it was my keyboard, that was the problem.
last year, that was it. Okay, and so the benefit there is you put it in a function, F8, and now you can just type this T over and over and over again, right? But then when I say get help, T, it's like, yeah, there's nothing there. And get nothing for you, okay? So then you can say, well, let's take this and you can parameterize it. And you say, hey, I'm gonna have $name, okay? And then say $name, run it again. And now I can say T
bits,
B star, okay? Don't have bits. Okay, so now you've parameterized it. So you started off, I mean, this is the way we envisioned it. You know, we started with the interactive shell, because you do things, Bruce Pat has this wonderful phrase. He says, the life cycle of most scripts begins at the prompt and ends at the carriage return. So it's an interactive environment. You're gonna do things. Then at some point you're gonna notice, boy, I keep doing that sequence over and over again. So you're gonna put it in a file. Then you're going to realize, well, that's almost right, except I change it every now and again. So then you're going to add this thing called a parameter. And then, let's see here, do get help again. Get help again, a little bit better. Yeah? And then what you can do is you can add this commandlet binding. Commandlet binding. And that turns it into a full commandlet. Oh, it being a full commandlet, it should have formal naming. And formal naming means verb noun. So now it's get T. Get T minus name. Now look at all that. I got all those extra parameters. How did I get all those extra parameters? And the answer is because I declared it a commandlet. We've now, you know, had our bar mitzvah, whatever that is. You've made a passage. You are now something new. You are now a full commandlet. Before this, you were just a little function. Now you're a real thing.
And the important thing to realize here is that, as he said, you don't have to start with the end state. You can start very simple. Run through several iterations, get it working, start adding to it. Then when you're done, you're like ready to release it into production, you can put all the commandlet bindings and the wrappers and stuff around it. Another thing I found is a lot of people really want to implement commands that look and work just like the real PowerShell commands. And so they'll code their own minus help parameter, and they'll code their own minus verbose parameter.
No.
And if you talk to those folks, they'll say, yeah, PowerShell is really kind of hard because to make something work consistently is a lot of work. That's because they're not taking the time to learn about that little secret, that commandlet binding. The shell will do most of the work for you if you want it to.
In fact, let me make an architectural point. That was the whole point, right? I sat there and I said, hey, I got to go get the entire world to write commandlets, right? Now, I have a very simple model here. Everybody's got a simple model. That is, people want to do the least amount of work and get the most amount of benefit. Kind of makes sense. So what we said was, hey, you can write the smallest amount of code possible, and we will host it in an environment that provides you tons of information, tons of extra value-added functions. Okay, and so that was the whole idea. So notice, all I did was add that one commandlet there, the commandlet binding, and I got all these extra functions. So look here, if I said minus name, star SS, now I can say minus output variable foo. Now I say $foo. See, what happens is when you do that, the way you want to think about this is as you write things, you put little pieces in your code to tell the hosting environment, hey, do this for me, do this for me, do this for me.
Here's another great example.
Step by step.
Let's say that we had a command and we needed one piece of information that was going to be, a parameter that was a file path. What's one thing you could see going wrong right away, perhaps? Maybe somebody providing a path that doesn't exist? Mm. How many of you who are used to programming will say, yeah, I'm definitely going to put some code in there to make sure that exists first? Yeah, do some data validation? As soon as you start thinking, I'm going to put some code, you might be working too hard. Because this is a case where I can ask the shell.
Oh, you like that one.
I really love this one. Somebody did this in the scripting games, and I thought, that is sexy. I never would have thought of that. Test path is going to take whatever was input to this and return a true or false. And if it's false, then the validate script attribute fails, and they get a normal shell-generated error message that explains what happened, and I didn't have to write any code at all. All I have to know is that the test path command is there, and it works. So, as you start building scripts and as you start putting these things together, take the time to find out what the shell will do for you. You will probably be shocked at the number of things it gives you absolutely free of charge. Just because, you know, how many of you learn by going up to people's blogs? Yeah, just because it's on the internet doesn't mean it's true or complete. So if you run across something on the internet, investigate it a little bit. Engage the curiosity part of your brain and find out what that does and what else might be there, because you can save yourself a ton of time.
Hey, run it. Show the error. I want to show him something.
All right. Run it.
What? Oops, while he's running that, how many of you work for or with people from other countries? Okay, great. So watch what happens when he runs this thing.
Let's do computer name, DC, file path. Oops, what did I do? File path.
Okay, so you see that error message there, okay? Now, again, you might have been tempted to say, oh, you know, that test, I'll just write it in the code myself, and I'll generate an error message. The difference is we generate a standard error message, okay, when this happens. We generate the standard error message. That means we translate it. If you were to run this script in France or wherever, the error message would come out in French. If you write this code, you're not going to write it in French. I just know that. And if you write it in French, I bet you're not going to write it in Russian. You use our messages, and we do that. The same thing with the mandatory. If you specify something that's mandatory or a validation parameter on something, and they don't do it, we generate the error message so the user can recognize it. They don't have to read it, and we do the translation. So the trick is all about how to get us to do work for you.
Sound good?
Happy?
Nod your heads up and down. There you go. Okay. All right.
It's about half, but I couldn't tell if it was the beginner half or the advanced half. So we have no actionable input.
That's okay. They look happy. The next thing we're going to talk about is jobs. And this is something that I think a lot of people overlook a little bit, or they think that it's just kind of task scheduler-ish. And and you know, it's task scheduler is a nice tool, but it's not really all that interesting. The thing with jobs is there's many different types of jobs, and although they were introduced in version 2, they evolved a little bit for version 3. These have always been an extension point. There are many different types of jobs that can do different things, and a developer can write more things that are called jobs that plug into the system. So PowerShell version 3, for example, did add something called a schedule job that lives outside the shell at the OS level, can run on a schedule even if PowerShell isn't running, potentially even if nobody's logged on, task scheduler based, but you can get in the shell to retrieve and work with those results. So you don't have to write your own log files, it persists the results for you automatically. And so that, in addition to some of the main job types having changed, gives you a lot of really cool things you can do with this. Jeffrey's gonna show you a demo in a sec, but I wanna kinda set your mind working in a direction. We're just now wrapping up the scripting games, scriptinggames.org. Big community competition, great opportunity to try your hand at some real world tasks and see what different people do. I'm delighted every time I look at this because I get some fantastic ideas that I never would have thought of. We posted one event and it was along the lines of, look, you need to reach out and do this thing to potentially thousands, tens of thousands of computers, but you're not sure if PowerShell remoting is going to be available in the environment. So you have to think around that. So folks actually used jobs to create a multi-threading system in PowerShell. They would launch several jobs, let this big task complete. Once those finished, they'd launch the next ones. Really, really clever stuff, once you kind of understand what these can do for you.
Yeah. So the thing you want to think through is that whenever you're running a command, it's running synchronously. Jobs are a way to run things asynchronously or in the background, okay? That's the way you want to think about it. So first, let's talk about what job commands I have. So we use the get command. Notice we have get job, receive job, resume, remove, start, stop, suspend, etc. Now here's the thing I want to be clear on. This is a pattern we have in PowerShell. It turns out that there are many ways to create a job. There are many domain-specific ways to create a job. I'm going to show you a few of them. But then once you have a job, there's a uniform way to interact with it no matter how it got created, okay? So the same thing with you if you think about it as drives. When I go create a new PS drive, there are different ways to create it, whether it's a cert drive, a file system drive, etc. There are lots of different ways to create these drives. But once I then have them, I CD into them, I do a dir, I do a remove, etc. So that's one of the key patterns we have with PowerShell. Domain-specific things where it's required, but then generic and common as much as possible, okay? So, concretely, I don't know if you knew this, we added this in this latest in version 3, but you can do get command minus parameter name. So this says, find me all the commands that have a parameter as job. And you see we got get WMI, object, so it has an as job, invoke command.
So that means all of these commands are capable of starting something called a job, and they all do so for a different reason, and they might use a different technology to communicate or whatever else, but once that job's created, it's a consistent type of thing that you can work with.
Exactly, so I'm gonna show you that. I'm gonna do three jobs. First, I'll do a get WMI object as a job, okay? Then I do start job, hello world, and then I do invoke command world as job. Invoke command, what as job? Oh, okay, minus computer name. Okay, so now I say get job.
You know, when I first saw this, I did this, I thought you guys must not be able to count very well because the ID numbers are 2, 4, and 6.
Yeah. That's true.
You just hated odd numbers or...
Exactly. Out to get them. I'll show you what that's about in a second. So what's going on here is you have the various jobs with the funky counting, okay? You have names, and here we just, if you don't give us a name, we assign you a name. You could have done a name. Last name, second time around. Okay. Now if I do it again, get job. Okay, so now I use my name. But no, notice here the job type. I got WMI jobs, I got background jobs, I got remoting jobs, etc. And you notice that I had different commands to generate them. But if I want to get the input from them, Receive job. By the way, I can never spell receive job. So I don't know if you know this trick. I before E, E before I. I'm like trying to tell myself that while I'm typing the wrong thing. So now I just type REC star job, and then tab. Because I'm horrible at it. I'm just horrible. Anyway, so you receive job, and you can give either the ID to, by the way, you can say keep. Just explain that. Okay? So that got me all the results for that. Let's do something simpler. Four. Oh, three. Damn. I did the reveal.
There are no odd numbers.
Exactly, there are. Okay, so get job, right? And I did four. I did get job four. I get that hello. I get job six. I get that. If I want to do eight, okay, so it's the same independent of the job, okay? Now, I noticed why I did this thing called keep. What's going on there is when I receive the job, I get the results. And I have two choices. I can either get the results and consume them, or I can sort of like peek at them. Like, I want to get them, but you keep them for now. And the point of that is I can just keep getting them and getting them and getting them until I do something that doesn't have a keep. And then I've consumed it. Okay, so now also notice get job. Notice here, has more data. Okay, so what that says is there's data. You can do a receive on it. Having done the non-keep version of receive for eight, you notice that has more data equals false. So there's no more data. All the others, there's more data. Okay, and also these things can run on different machines, so it tells you what machine and it'll tell you what actually ran.
Okay. Now, probably this isn't many of you. How many of you find that you sometimes have to do more than one thing at once at work? Oh, okay. Well, then these are useful.
Yeah.
Because that's the idea. Even if you have to write a script, like I said, people use this to create some kind of multi-threading and, you know, I need this to run on 20 computers, and I'll do that on one job and this on 20 other computers, and really clever stuff they did.
Now, you've got multiple machines, right? So this would work better on your machine. Which one are you?
That one, the purple one.
They're all purple, aren't they? Yeah. Do like an invoke command as job on anything, like get, no.
Oh, come on.
No. Host name. Host name. Something small.
Okay. Yeah. You just want to do like that or something?
That's not host name, but okay.
It's the same thing.
Minus computer, and then like three or four names minus as job. Okay, now do a get job.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? Yeah. Get out of my way.
I wondered how long that was going to last.
Okay, minus. Okay, how do you do this thing? What the hell? Where do you do this thing? What? Okay. Here's the deal. Let's do it this way. $J equals get job. $J dot through format list star. Okay, now notice here, somewhere here, there's something called child jobs. Okay, and this is why things increment. Whenever you create a job, what really happens is you create a parent job, a controlling job, and then you create one or more child jobs.
Every computer that's dealing is one child job, so you can break them out separately.
Exactly. So in fact, what's happening is get job, I can say get job three, get job four, get job five, and they fail. Why did they all fail?
Oh, I don't have remoting turned on the client.
That's
great.
You
didn't say that. Oh, yeah, I didn't put the right command either. There's that.
Well, hey, how about we use host name? That'd work. Host name. Get $J equals get job six. J. Failed. You're right. You're killing me. Anyway.
I really don't have remoting turned on the computer.
So it wouldn't have helped. Anyway. So the point is, well, now I can't show this. What you can do is you can receive individual jobs. Seven minus keep. Doesn't matter. Oh,
yeah, the DC worked.
oh, the DC worked. Yeah. Okay, so or 8. Yeah, and that one failed.
But
okay,
you can get the error messages at least.
You can get the error messages. Now look what happened here. I did this on 2 machines, and it came out as 6. So if I do a receive job minus, you said job 6 minus keep, it shows me the error. Why didn't it show me the other one?
You didn't do a keep the first time. Oh, you didn't.
I did. Now if I do 7.
RC. That's some goofy alias you came up with.
6 minus keep.
There you're going to bounce.
There it goes. Okay, so what it does was, it now, I did a receive on the controlling job, the parent job. So here's the thing. I do something, I always create a parent, and then I create one or more children. I can, when I talk to the parent, it's as though I talk to each one of the children as a collective. Alternatively, I can go to any one of the children and deal with it, okay? So here, I did the parent, and so I get DC and the error. If I wanted to go just to one of the children, 6, 7, I get the value, and the next one, I get the error. Ta-da.
How many of you get stressed out by the red text? Like high school English class?
No, none of them. They love it.
I absolutely
Who
do,
loves
too.
Red? Love the red.
Private data.
Hey, you know what? In China, red means great. It does. They love red.
Don't you feel better now?
What? What'd you do? What? What?
Plus, you can read it better.
Oh, yeah. Did you know you could control that? You can read it better. That's good.
All right. Next up.
Oh, wait. Did I do everything?
Hold yeah. On.
No, I didn't
no,
do
did
everything.
You not?
No. So here's the point. That's
the
just
red
the point.
Text really does stress me out.
Okay. Thanks for sharing. It's all about you, Don. It's all about you. All right. So what I want to show here was workflow. Okay, so workflow, you know, workflow, everybody familiar with workflow? So workflow is just like functions, except it's
how many
not.
How many of you know about workflow? Yeah?
Oh,
if you don't, get on technetmagazine.com. Every single month, this is a year-long tutorial on workflow. It's free. You don't have to pay for it. You can read up on it.
Okay, so workflow, remember the model, right? So you write a little bit of code. You provide it in an environment where we host it, and we provide a ton of value for you. Okay, so now you've done that with functions. Now you're going to do it with workflows. With workflow, here I got a little piece of code that says get process star, but I declare it a workflow instead of a function. Okay, now check this out. Right? Remember how many parameters I got when I just added the word commandlet binding? So watch this. Test workflow dash. And look at these things. Man, there's a gazillion. And why? And the answer is that functions run in the PowerShell engine. These things run in the workflow engine, right? We have actually 2 separate execution engines. And the workflow engine has a lot of extra parameters. You can run things here, you can run things there, et cetera. And you can run things as a job. Job name, test. So now it's running. Now we see another one, PS workflow job, its name, and that it has more data. Okay, so then when it's done, receive job 10. Oh, geez, Louise. Receive job 10, I get the stuff. All happiness. And then as Don was mentioning, we have
scheduled jobs.
Scheduled jobs. So here's an example of the module for scheduled jobs. In the past, that was kind of tough to do. Now it's a whole lot easier. So you see we've got job triggers, we've got scheduled jobs, we've got job options. So here, if you want to see an example of the job triggers, you see you can run things once, you can run them daily, you can run them weekly, you can run them at logon, you can run them at startup time. So here's an example of a trigger that says I want to run it once at, and I just take now and I add an hour. Okay, and that's a trigger.
So come back in an hour.
Come back in an hour. Or next week, next Friday at 6 p.m., right? That's a weekly trigger. Okay, I'm going to store that one. A daily trigger says every day at 3 a.m. And now here I'm going to schedule 2 jobs. I got a daily backup job, so I'm going to give it a name. So now I'm registering it. And what's happening is all the other jobs that I talked about are sort of like controlled by my process. And if that process goes away, you lose it all, okay? These, however, don't, right? These, well, workflows, not quite that way. That's a more complicated conversation. But these, I'm working with these task scheduler on Windows. And so I'm registering these with the task scheduler. So these are going to run independent of PowerShell of any PowerShell session. So what I'm saying for my daily backup, I give it a set of triggers. So this script block, this copy file, is going to run on my daily trigger, which is today, is to say every day at 3 a.m., and my weekly trigger, every Friday at 6 p.m., I'm going to run this thing. Okay?
How many of you have scheduled PowerShell scripts for various whatever? How many have struggled with it maybe a little bit? Because sometimes it's, you got to schedule PowerShell.exe, and then you got to get all the... This is in every copy of PowerShell version 3, and it is the by far the easiest way to run PowerShell scripts on a schedule because it understands, and it'll persist your results for you. You won't have to code that. Remember, less work.
Yes. So here I get the scheduled jobs, and I'm seeing all of those. If I want to see what a job trigger looks like, I get the scheduled job, and I pipe it to get job trigger. You see, there's the daily. I can get the here are the job options, right? So you can configure whether it's going to run on batteries, whether it's going to run elevated, whether it'll wake up. I mean, just everything you can do, most everything you can do in the job scheduler, you can do here. So pretty great stuff. And let's see, I'm just going to do one last thing here. This up. Oh, sorry. Right, I'm supposed to run this in a separate window. That's why. Pay no attention to me. Okay, so now...
How many of you knew you could do that with the ISE? You see it's got the two square tabs up top? That's like having two separate windows. They're separate run spaces. It's kind of easy to not discover that, but it's a neat trick.
All right. So now what I did is I started up a new session. I ran get scheduled job, and what I'm seeing is the results of something I had run prior. Okay. So this has all the results. Okay. So I'm going to go in here, and instead of getting 2, I'm going to get 18. Okay, so what I had, I had job scheduler some time ago. In fact, this morning, I set up some scheduled jobs, and they've been running in the background. Now, I start up a new session, and by the way, in between those, I did a system reboot. Okay, so they just kept running in the background. Now I come here, I do get scheduled jobs. That talks to the task scheduler, finds out what's available. They now show up in my job queue, get jobs. I'm able to show you the results. I can show you the fact that when they began and when they ended. So that was today at 5. I was up early, 5 and 6 I was doing this stuff. And and here's the keep results. Oh, 6. It wasn't 6. It was 19. Sorry. Hardwired numbers, man. That's bad. Anyway, so that is jobs. So there's lots of different ways to create jobs. There's a uniform way to interact with jobs. That's a pattern you'll see over and over again with PowerShell, so learn it. And then in PowerShell version 3, we did a much better job of making it easy to schedule jobs and schedule script blocks with the task scheduler.
I'm actually going to switch right over to here.
Ooh.
Switch right over to here. There it goes. So as you start using these different tools and you start building out the functionality and you start building advanced functions and you start using things like jobs and you start really building tools, you're going to want other people to use those, right? So you're going to need to distribute those. The way I've written this right now is not a terribly good way to distribute this, because if you just run this script, I took the command out of the bottom. So if you just run this, it doesn't do anything. The script runs, it defines the function, and then the script goes away, and the function goes away with it. So the way things get bundled up into packages that get distributed in PowerShell is a module. Turning this into a module is very, very tricky. Watch. You have to do save as, and in my documents folder, you need to be real careful that it goes into my documents. I'm going to create a folder called Windows PowerShell, all one word. Under there, a folder called Modules. Now you need to think of a name for your tool. I'm just going to call it My Tools and save my script in there as mytools.psm, M as in Mary, 1. How many of you think you could pull that off? All right, well, that's all you have to do.
They didn't all raise their hands.
No, they didn't all raise their hands. No.
Must have been the beginners.
I think it's the post-lunch lack of caffeine, probably.
Yes.
Or they're playing their fun books, probably, crosswords.
Ah, yeah, good, good, good.
So now, I because I'm in PowerShell 3, I don't even have to load that into memory. I can just type the name of my command, hit tab, it'll tab complete it for me, tab complete my names, oops, and it'll
do
run.
Do your green text?
My green error text. So you can put as many of those functions into a script module as you want to. Now, here's the neat trick.
Wait, did you explain how you did that?
Here's what happened?
Did you explain why you didn't have to import the module?
Yeah, I'm getting there.
Oh, sorry.
Here's the neat thing I want you to do, though. How many of you could see yourself writing a big tool that does something, but inside it calls several other littler things that you might have written, little module, you know, modular code, right? Okay. Inside of the module, at the bottom of it, you can run a command called export module member. The default, if you don't use this, is to make everything in here available to whoever has the module. But when I do this, now the only thing someone can use is get sysinfo. Anything else will be hidden. It'll still be usable by all the code that's in the same module, but no one else will be able to touch it. So that when they come down to the command line, and I'm just going to take this off real quick so that you can kind of see. Actually, you know what? I'll put a fake function in here real quick. Function fake.
Fake one.
There. And we'll go ahead and export the real one.
No, you got to show them that if you don't do that, you'll see everything.
Well, we already saw everything.
No, you didn't.
Oh, fine.
No, go ahead. Do them wrong.
Remove
I
module.
I think they deserve your best.
My tools. Go play with your laptop. Isn't it touchscreen? So now if I'm going to explicitly import this, just so you know that I did it. PowerShell 3, you don't have to explicitly import modules most of the time, provided the modules live in the right place. And I'll show you in a sec where the right place is. But I did explicitly import this, and I can run fake, and I can run my get sysinfo. And it's going to prompt me for the computer name. So let's get rid of that again. Remove module, my tools. ENV PS module path. Oops. I don't know why I have a problem with that today.
No slash.
Yeah, no slash. ENV PS module path. That's where you're allowed by default to put your modules. You'll notice one of those is system 32. Here's a tip. Don't put your stuff in system 32. He puts his stuff in system 32. You can put your stuff wherever you want to and add your path to this one. This is a Windows level environment variable, which means you can control it with group policy. So you could push out a nice set of locations for all of your admins to store all of your corporate modules. You will notice that when you install tools, they may modify this path so that PowerShell can find their module as well. You install the admin tools for SQL Server, for example. It updates this, thank God. And so by having things there, you can let the shell auto-load or auto-discover. Here's a couple ways that works.
You didn't show them the fake.
The fake?
The export.
Well, I haven't removed it yet.
Yeah.
I just want to make sure it's not loaded. Okay. So I can run get sysinfo. I have not loaded this module, but PowerShell is going to already have found it so that I can tab complete it. But if I try to run fake, why is it running?
Because you didn't re-import it.
Oh, I didn't remove it. Remove
you
module.
You did remove it. You forgot to update it and
import.
Save it.
No. I saved it. Look, it's not. It's,
look.
It's. Oh, that.
That. Oh, that.
Oh. You're confusing me.
Oh, that.
Import module my tools.
You should tweet that all.
Now,
everyone.
This should be there, right?
Famous Don word, Don Jones words. Oh, that.
It's not nearly as famous as the baby through. Anyway. I've loaded this into memory. It should be there, but I can't run fake. because in my module, I have now explicitly listed the things I want to be visible, and anything else won't be. You can do more than just functions. You can export aliases, which means you can define your own aliases in here using new alias. You can do variables, which means you can have module-level variables that load into the shell when you load the module and unload from the shell when the module gets removed, so it cleans up after itself. This is a great way to create your own preference variables. Let's say you have a bunch of functions that are going to write errors to a log, and you want to have a default log file name that's easily overridden. You could put that in a module-level variable, and people will be able to modify it just like they would any of the shell's built-in preference variables. So you can do quite a bit to make this neat and structured and useful. You just have to remember to uncomment the line.
Yeah, that's important. Hey, you know, my OCD's kicking in. Do you mind if I show them something?
No.
So have you ever been like looking at code and you're like, where the heck am I? Like you see all these like squiggle brackets, like where does that, and you're like, oh, does that line up? And then like this one, like that one probably lines up with this, may or may not, and then this one, what's that? And so there's a couple things. First is, you see here, you can do this like compress. I don't know how to use your damn thing. Okay. And so there's two tricks I want to show you. One is you can go here and do this, right? Compress it. And then I like to do this. Step here and I say pound sign process. And then you come back here. Wah. Okay. So anyway, that's one trick. The other trick is you can go and you can select this thing. And
yeah, you know,
say,
let me do this because the color's up there, hard to read, but I can zoom it in. So what he's done is I've just put the cursor right next to this, and you see how it's got a gray background? That lines up with the gray background on the one it matches with.
Or you can hit Control Squiggle Bracket.
Control Squiggle Bracket?
Yeah, that one.
Oh yeah.
And it goes back and forth.
See the cursor moving?
There you go. There's your advanced tip of the day. Don't say you didn't get anything out of this. Hey, I just find when you get these nested stuff, I often find that bottoms are like, where did that thing come from? And so this idea of like collapsing the regions,
yeah,
just
so
collapse
that,
it.
Again, because it's hard to see. This is what he was clicking over there, is these little minuses. And that pulls in that entire construct.
Now, why? They're big on mine. What are you doing?
It's the theme that this is running in.
Oh.
With that theme, for some reason, because I've got it shrunk down a little from
the
theme.
ISC, you got a themed ISC? See here in ISC?
Yeah.
That's much nicer.
Yeah, it's because those increase with the slider.
Okay.
I just didn't feel I needed a 98-point font.
Yeah, well, you'll get there, my friend.
I know. I am. I'm getting there. All right, so those are modules. Let's see what's next. Remoting improvements.
Do we do all the interesting things outside of modules? Modules, import. Yeah, good.
Modules are fun. So why don't you talk about some of these improvements?
Okay, so we always get things out there and then we're not done, man. We just keep improving it. So we've improved the, in version 3, we introduced remoting in version 2 and then improved it in version 3. So in version 3, now you have disconnected sessions, okay? So the idea here was I'm out on my machine and I'm managing some remote server, and I'm doing some action, and,
let's show robust. You want me to show them?
Okay, sure.
Well, I can show them disconnected.
Okay.
At least. So I'll get a session going to a machine. We'll, let's see, DC equals new PS session, computer name, DC. And I'll invoke some command on there. Invoke command against the session DC, and we'll just give it a directory listing. So now I'm bored. You know, that's going to run for a little while. I want to go off somewhere else, and I need to get off this computer because someone else needs to use it. I can disconnect. Oh, wow. I love that we have all these commands, but it kills my tab completion habits.
Yeah.
I can disconnect that session. It's still running on the DC. It's still there, but I'm not hooked up to it anymore. Kind of like the same thing you can do with a remote desktop connection-ish, kind of, right? So it's still over there. It's still running. I can scurry over here to a new computer and say, get PS session from that computer. Ah, there's one still running, and it's mine. So I can reconnect that. and now I'll have it again, and I can even go in and use it interactively if I want to. Really not used to it. And so now I'm on that same session that's been running. You can set some rules for idle, timeout, max memory. There's all the types of rules you can set to how long it'll keep, that type of thing.
Yep. And actually, we want to build, we should have talked about robust sessions first.
Yeah.
So robust sessions, so here's the way it works. A little bit not unintuitive, but PowerShell remoting works over HTTP. Now, as you know, HTTP is sessionless, right? You just continue to do that. However, WSMAN, so PowerShell is layered on top of WSMAN, which is layered on top of HTTP. HTTP is sessionless. WSMAN effectively put a session on top of it. And so what happened, well, actually TCP, when you create an HTTP interaction, you create a TCP connection, and then you do that. And what happened is when the TCP would time out, it would tell the upper layer, and then the upper layer says, yeah, it doesn't matter, just recreate it. WSMAN, however, said, oh, I've got a broken TCP connection, which would then break the PowerShell connection. We decided that was the wrong semantics. Instead, we put true WSMAN session semantics into it. And so now we talk to a remote machine, we create an HTTP TCP connection. If that TCP connection breaks, WSMAN will note it and will attempt to recreate a TCP connection. And it will continue to do this, I think, for, you can configure it, but I think it's default to like 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay? So, you know, we will keep trying. Next is PowerShell has a proper session on top of it, and that's session on top of the WSMAN session. The PowerShell session can say, hey, I would like to disconnect from the WSMAN session, and then it can reconnect from a different machine, at a different time, et cetera. Okay, so the kind of two scenarios were, hey, I'm in somewhere, and I'm at my laptop, and I'm managing some machine, and I'm performing some operation, and I close my laptop, and I'm going across to the other building, right? I get to the other building, I open it up, and it continues to still work. That's a good one. The next is, hey, I'm doing some work, and it's gonna. I gotta check on these results, but it's like 6 o'clock, and the wife's not gonna be happy if I don't get home. What am I gonna do? And the answer is, I disconnect my session, I leave my machine here, I go home. When I'm home, I say, "Hun, I'll be right with ya." I log in, I reconnect to that session, I get the results, do whatever mediation's required.
And she's okay with that, but not you being late.
Yes.
Okay.
That's the way it works.
All right, as long as you have an agreement. Now, the next remoting improvement, and this is something you absolutely could have done in version 2, but it has been made much, much simpler in version 3. How many of you, anybody rebuild your admin workstation recently? How long did it take? About a week? Because you got to go dig up all the stupid DVDs and CDs and jam all the tools onto there. How many of you actually, instead of installing the admin tools on your workstation, you just RDP into a server because you're tired of installing the tools? Yeah, stop that. You're going to go to hell. That's really why we have to reboot the server. So look, here's how much easier it got. This is a Windows 8 computer right now. I've got a domain controller running in the background over here. So this is a Windows 8 machine. I have not installed the remote server administration toolkit on here. I don't have anything more than Windows 8 is natively born with. But I do have a domain controller out there. And it is running Active Directory because that's what they do. Did you know that domain controllers have a very high speed connection to AD? It's weird. So rather than spending the time installing the tools on my computer, I'm going to say import module, Active Directory. I want to do that using that session to my DC that I'd created a little bit ago. And just for my own memory purposes, I'm going to put a little prefix, REM. That's just going to remind me that these are coming from a remote computer. This is going to go out to that computer. In the copy of PowerShell running on that computer, it just loaded the AD module, enumerated all the commands, created little shortcuts on my computer. So when I run get AD user,
oh, rem.
I forgot because I put a prefix. It's get rem AD user minus filter star. it runs the command on the DC, which has a very high speed connection to itself because it's there, and then just the results come back over to my computer. Now, how many of you have gone through an Exchange migration, maybe 07 to 10? Neatest trick in the world I saw a customer do one time was on his Windows 7 computer, he imported the 2007 commands with the prefix 2007 and imported the 2010 commands with the prefix 2010, and he could sit and just by changing it from get 2007 mailbox to get 2010 mailbox, he knew the command was being sent to the right server to run directly on the Exchange server. Isn't that a neat trick?
And presumably you could do a get from this, pipe to a set.
You can get and do a set because it passes the objects.
Whoa, that's
really clever. How many of you have ever run into the situation where, you know, I've got a bunch of 2012 servers and I want to put the Windows 8 RSAT, but I've got a Windows 7 machine and you can't, the tool versions never match up.
Yes.
This solves that because that background DC isn't a 2012 DC. So I've actually made sure that I can load all the tools into one shell because they're not really running on my computer. It's just there for convenience sake. Again, this is something you can do in PowerShell version 2. It just takes two or three commands to do it. In version 3, they tightened it up so that it works across just one simple command.
Yeah, how many people? Oh, got a question.
To secure so that the wrong person can't run it? Well, so you mean the communications? You're going to have to use the floor mic because it's tough to hear. There's a lot of error handling equipment up here.
Okay. I was just thinking about when we write those modules, is there some way that we can encrypt those modules so that they when they sit on the...
What do you want to do?
He wants to hide them.
Just hide them so that somebody doesn't go in and change them.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so
If I wanted to distribute some code modules to a customer, I want to do some protection of those.
Yeah, the solution for that is to kill the person when they do it. Make sure the punishment is very, very severe.
Yeah, okay. No.
We don't support obfuscation. That's obfuscation. Yeah. By the way, how many people use implicit remoting or have used it? Okay, it's really an amazing thing. I don't know if you kind of zoom past it. It's worth explaining what happens. I mean, literally, as you know, when you write this code, PowerShell owns the parser, right? We own the parser, and ultimately we call your code. Okay, so here what we've done is we go out and we connect to the remote machine, and we go and we talk to ourselves. Hey, PowerShell on remote PowerShell, tell me everything you know about parsing that module, all the commands. And we have that metadata, and then we bring it over here, and because we know that, we then generate functions that have exactly the same signature, and then when you call them, we know how to go out remotely to do the action.
And that's why if I try to pull up that list of commands, they're not showing up as commandlets, they're showing up as functions, because the ones that live on my computer are actually just these little faked out shortcuts. And they're sending the command under the hood off to the real machine that's really running it, and it's sending the results back to me. Uh-oh.
Where's your...
Ah. You don't want to do that.
No. Help.
Oh, great. I don't know how to get back now.
Oh. Go to a code editor.
Like ISE?
Yeah. And like new
window. Oh, you just
want to... What I did was... What? Oh, I screwed up.
Oh. So it's not my fault this time.
This time. Sorry. What I meant was this.
There's no home button. We covered that last year.
Oh, yeah. I remember from year to year. And then...
Well, there's this thing at the bottom. You guys invented this. My God.
Okay, so here is... So what happens is that I did a get command of the export the new commandlet, the rem commandlet, and I grabbed its definition. And here's its definition. It's PowerShell scripting code. Okay? So we wrote the PowerShell script, and then down here deep in the... Deep in the... What are you doing?
I have no idea. That's your shortcut.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go.
I just work here.
Deep in the details, you go and we do the remote invocation. So this is actually pretty fun code to look at and learn some tricks.
Here's another thing. This is actually called a proxy function because it's not doing anything. It's proxying it in the background to someone else who's doing it. Once you have something like this, you can go start adding parameters, deleting parameters, making sure that a help desk technician only has a dumbed down or a spruced up version of the command that you've customized, but you don't actually have to do any coding because the real command is going to do all the work under the hood. And there's even a way to load this so it overrides the real one so that it's a little harder for them to get at the real one. You can do a lot of cool things with these.
And the community does that a lot. You'll say, hey, PowerShell, you guys, you missed a parameter. You should have added this parameter. And what someone will do is they'll go and they'll use this technique to create a proxy function. Then they'll add that parameter and add the function to it and distribute it. And now all of a sudden you've got a version of the commandlet that has that function. Earlier down on the show floor, we were talking to someone who wanted to say, hey, I'm going to let people have access to my machine, but I don't want them to be able to do everything. And so I showed them how they can hide certain commands and how what you can do is you can use this proxy function to hide the original one, create a replacement, and remove certain functions or add additional constraints on it. So you really lock down what people are able to do.
And these custom session configurations, which we'll talk about next, are a neat place to use those. And we've already talked a little bit about remoting. If you look at any machine that has remoting enabled, let's see, I'll go ahead and turn it on here now.
Enable. Oh, you want to hear something cool? Announcement. We haven't talked about this today yet.
Uh-oh.
It's cool. NDA. Seriously. So if you're a Twitter guy, you're going to tweet this. You'll be the first in the Twitterverse with this out there. Next version of Windows Server 2012. PowerShell execution environment. So in this version, PowerShell remoting was turned on by default. Next version, PowerShell execution policy becomes remote signed instead of restricted.
Ooh, default exec, hang on, I'm on Twitter. Policy is remote signed. Look, it even capped it for me.
Yeah,
nice. Okay, I'm hitting tweet.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wait,
all
that's
right.
NDA. Little NDA.
Dope.
You're going to have to get the Twitter universe on NDA. That's
once good. Once you enable this remoting, by default, PowerShell creates several different session configurations for different purposes. The one that you normally will connect to is this Microsoft.PowerShell. This is a 64-bit machine, so that is a 64-bit session. You can create your own. And normally, this is a two-step process. I'm going to kind of show you the commands, and then I'll show you one that I already set up. The first thing I'll usually do is new PS session configuration file. This lets you create a file that defines some of the characteristics of your new endpoint. And there's a lot of things you can do in here, but some of the cooler ones are you can set a language mode. And this determines how much of the PowerShell scripting language is going to be available to someone who connects to this. You can specify that certain modules be pre-imported into this so that whoever connects to it gets those commands right off the bat. But maybe they don't get all of them. Maybe they only get the commandlets, providers, functions, and so forth that you specify. So load the Active Directory module, but hide everything that isn't set AD account password, because that's all I want someone to be able to do. So this creates a file on disk, and then that gets used by register PS session configuration. As a caution, this normally requires that the WinRM service be bumped. It has to restart it. You can suppress that, but the new configuration doesn't take effect until the service gets restarted. This lets you do a couple of cool things. Show security descriptor UI will pop up the normal OS security dialog box so that you can decide who may connect to this, and you can specify that a credential other than theirs will be used to run everything in here. So you don't have to give them permission to run the commands they're going to run. You specify a secret account that's going to do it instead.
Now this is worth slowing down on, because this is a crucial point. So you say, hey, I'm responsible for this resource. this disks, the storage, this networking, SharePoint, whatever. And you come to me and say, I need to do this, you know, and it requires admin privs. And there's like, no freaking way I'm giving you admin privs to my machine.
No, I don't even have a home key.
If you screwed up, I'm going to, exactly, on that device, if you screwed up, I'm going to get held responsible. So, but tell me what it is you need to do. And it's typically just a few things. And so what you say is, great, you're going to stay user. You're not getting admin privileges. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to create an environment that you can only do those two things. You can log into it, and then when you run it, I'm going to run it as someone else, a local administrator or, you know, my account or whatever.
Now, piece this together with two other things that we already showed you. You can write your own modules. Those can be the ones that load into the custom session. Your module can contain proxy functions that take an existing command and dumb it down or hard code certain values so that now he's not only given me a subset, he's given me a tiny, teeny, teeny, teeny little subset. I can't even run the whole command. I can only run this special version he gave me, and he didn't really have to code any of that. It's really doing all the same commands under the hood. He's just taking away buttons that I might not need to push.
Now, if you want to really complete it, now you think about the situation where you say, I got a few of those things. And now I'm here, and as part of my profile, I go and I do implicit remoting of the SharePoint commands that you gave me access to, of the storage commands that you gave me access to the networking capabilities that you gave me access to the SQL commands you gave me access to. And I'm here, and I do get help, and I see all the commands, storage, networking, SharePoint, disk, etc. And I just type as I will, and they're automatically going out there using a different account, going to this guy, using a different account, etc. But to me, I have a unified, coherent experience. I can get commands from here and get objects from here and pipe them there. And all the traversal of machines and credentials happens seamlessly behind the covers. That's what we've been working towards. We call this architecture.
Now, here's an example. No, clap. It's good. It's a lot of work. Here's an example. On my domain controller, I have created a custom session configuration called Alt, A-L-T. It pre-imports the server manager module, which has about three commands, but only the get Windows feature one is visible. So when I invoke, this is an important bit, the language mode is no language. There is no PowerShell language. The only thing that will work is that command, hopefully. So this is going to go out, and it ran that command. So, okay, I'm an auditor, and my job is I need to be able to review the features that are installed on servers to make sure it matches what the documentation says should be on that server. Great, you can do that. Yeah, you know what, but I'm also kind of a little crazy, so let me just see if I can run add Windows feature. Nope, I don't know what that is. It's not visible. I do have the entire server manager module, but I've only made this one command available. Oh, all right, you know what? I'm a power user. I'm just going to get right into this thing interactively. You told me this was configuration name Alt. I can't even get in interactively because not enough of PowerShell is turned on to spin up the interactive bit. So you can really, really get very specific and creative with these things. You need to think about these and really plan them out and do your testing and everything else, but these are a really, really powerful feature that people are just starting to take advantage of.
Can you do an import module of that? Or
Import a module through here?
Yeah.
I doubt it.
Import that command as a module.
Just from that session or from the normal session?
From that session.
I don't have a session.
Never mind.
I don't have a session there.
Okay.
I was interactively.
The point I wanted to make was that there are certain things, certain functions that require some commandlets in a run space. So the reason why the interactive stuff didn't work, if you take a look at the error message, is it required get command. So without get command, and I think there's a couple others, interactive sessions won't work. And so the question was, hey, if I wanted to do implicit remoting to that run space and get that one command here.
It won't work.
Yeah, okay, so there's probably some other commands that are required there.
So you have import module won't run.
Okay.
Because I didn't enable that either. And I had the whole language shut down on that one.
Yeah, there you go. Now, does this language mode, does everybody grok the language mode thing? Let me just show you an example of language mode. And what I'll do is, because this is a destructive process, I'll do Control-T, give myself a new run space, and I can do things like, you know, 2 plus 2, and that works, right? But then there's this style assigned host dot, what is it, ps session, where is it? Do you know where we put it?
I don't know what you're doing.
Language. Run space dot session state. I have no idea where we put language mode. Dang. So this is.
I thought it was under the invocation object.
No, you show them. I'll search the internet. No.
I want to see if he uses Google.
Stop.
All right, hang on.
What is it?
No, culture's not. So culture is your language, French, English, German. Language is its language. Language mode being the scripting language, the if construct, the for each, the ability to use a variable. That's part of the PowerShell language. And so in that alternate endpoint that I created, I turned all that off. Variables won't work. No command that I didn't explicitly allow will work. You wouldn't be able to do a script block. You wouldn't be able to do anything that involves part of PowerShell's scripting language, just running commands. That's all that endpoint is good for. There's also full language, which is everything. That's what you normally get in a shell. And then there's also a restricted subset that gives you a few core scripting language features, but not very much.
I can't find it. No internet connection.
Oh, well. I told you that internet thing was not going to catch on.
Never take stock advice from Don.
All right. Talk a little bit, because in version 3, all of a sudden, I had a whole new set of commands that seemed to duplicate everything I had before.
They did.
What's the deal?
Okay, so WMI, history, WMI is our implementation of the DMTF standards. The DMTF's been around for many, many years, and this was basically an early implementation of those standards. The standards moved on, and in particular, most importantly, they had a protocol. So prior to this, the standards didn't have a protocol, so it's just an object model, and so we used DCOM. So all the WMI stuff that you do uses DCOM. We are, as part of our CloudOS initiative, we are leveraging standards-based management to manage everything in the data center. And the way we're going to do that is leveraging standards-based management, the latest standards. So WSMAN using SIM. So if you've seen some of my sessions, I show using PowerShell and standards-based management, you can actually go out and manage Arista switches. And we showed a technology demonstration of it working against Cisco switches as well. Okay, so we want to be able to manage everything using these standards. And so we needed to bring our commandlets up to speed with that. And so let me first start by showing the one and only thing you still want to use WMI commandlets for, and that's this, okay? So this says, let me first run it because it takes a while. So get WMI object minus list, that's list things, and right here, this recurse. Right now, WMI has the ability to recurse through namespaces, okay, to find all the properties. So I start off in the root namespace, and I'm looking for things that have the word disk in it, and I run it as a job. So minus as job and minus recurse are the two reasons why you'd want to use WMI, or there's a continued reason. And honestly, we're going to fix that at some point. It was just fell below the cut line. Okay, now, and so there it is running in the background, and you can see get sign J equals get job 29, sign J, it's continuing to run, RCJB, sign J minus keep, and I'm getting things, and it'll go on in the background, good stuff. However, now there's a new set of commandlets, and these are the sim commandlets. So they are in a module called sim commandlets, that makes sense. And you see we've got get sim class, that's how you get the sim classes. If you want to get a sim instance, you do a get sim instance. And a bunch of things support the sim session. Okay, so for instance, let me show you this. Get disk, right? So get disks runs. But I can say minus sim session, and I can give a remote machine. Okay, and why is that? And the answer is, of the bulk of the 2,400 commandlets that we did in 2012, the bulk of those were actually written as SIM commandlets, which is to say they're written using SIM and available through WSMAN. And that means that we can run them here, we can run them there, we can run them anywhere against using WSMAN. Okay, so here I can do a get SIM class against a class. And notice, instead of getting WMI objects now, you get SIM objects. And these SIM objects are great, because what you can do is, unlike a WMI object, you can serialize them and deserialize them. You can I can print it out, and I can give it to you, and you can type it back in, and you get a SIM object. I mean, it's just crazy this way. You can put them in databases. You can move them around and just continue to always be able to get the SIM object and rebind it back to the instance. So here we can do a get SIM instance of Win32 process. So all pretty simple stuff. Most of the things that you were able to do, you were able to do. Now, if you wanted to do this via DCOM, so by default it's WSMAN, if you wanted to do these things via DCOM, what you would do is you'd say $SO equals new SIM session option minus protocol. And you have DCOM default WSMAN. So you'd say DCOM. And then here you'd say minus options.
SIM session.
Oh, SIM session. Sorry.
Yeah, you got to start a session first.
I got to say $S equals new SIMs.
So, I mean, the upshot here is that this can still talk to all the old machines. By default, SIM wants to talk over PowerShell remoting. What he's doing is setting up a session to make it talk the old WMI way, the DCOM way. So this same command can now work both ways. It wants to work the new way by default, but you can easily make it work the old way. How many of you have scripts that use get WMI object? There is a strong argument for revisiting those and migrating them to use the new commands, which is, how much investment are you guys going to put into get WMI object from here on out? So if I want better performance, if I want new features, if I want better performance.
Our next major investment in WMI is pulling those commandlets out of the operating system. Now that'll take a while, so, but ultimately that's where we're gonna go.
Begin the process. Don't let this wait forever. At the very least, start running some find and replaces and finding the scripts that are affected so that you can have a list, a to-do list. Hey boss, got to get on this someday. Just remember, if I get hit by a bus, this has still got to be done.
Yeah, and
because the investment is going to be on the new stuff now.
And having learned these SIM commandlets, you'll be able to apply those against the heterogeneous, our data center abstraction layer, the DAL. As we go and we get Arista switches, Cisco switches, all those switches, network storage, etc. These commandlets will work against those things. WMI never will. Not too many people pounding on the door saying, please let us implement DCOM.
And understand the migration process is purely syntactic. It is not going to take you a long time. It is just very minor syntax changes from the one set of commands over.
We have 2 minutes and we have...
Well...
What do you want to do? Debugging?
Yeah, no, let's just take a question. I think this is our last one. They don't care about debugging. I never write bugs anyway, so it's fine.
Exactly. Best tip of... Actually, it's Dave Cutler. Dave Cutler, I don't know, you know Dave. Dave's a hoot, right? And he said... The problem with some piece of software was PEE, or no, PPE. It's like, PPE? He says, yeah, piss poor engineering. He says, here's the rule. Don't put bugs in, and you don't have to take them out.
So,
pretty good rule.
Because we're running real up on the end of our time here, I want to let you know where we can be found. I'm heading downstairs right now to the conference bookstore to do a book signing. I'll be there for about half an hour. Most of the rest of the time, I will be over in the community resources zone at the Scripting Guys booth, representing PowerShell.org. We still have some of our free books up here. You're welcome to grab one of those on the way out. Grab a sticker. There's more of those down at the booth. Please stop by, ask questions, offer comments. Jeffrey's really busy at these events, so I'll try and take notes and pass things along as appropriate. But please engage and let us know. Also, please fill out an eval for this. That's incredibly important.
People love the evals. Don't forget your books here. And thanks.
And we'll see you. Thank you.
That went well. That went much better than I thought it was going to go.